It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this week. On Monday, after listening to almost 2 weeks of testimony, a jury of 7 women and 5 men returned a verdict in a murder case that has haunted the community of Cedar Rapids for 40 years.
The verdict appears to be in order. The members of the jury, through the foreman, have signed verdict form number 1. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jerry Lynn Burns, guilty of the charge of murder in the first degree, dated this 24th day of February 2020, signed by the foreman of the jury, Mr. Lynch.
The voice of Judge Faye Hoover on Monday. Jerry Lynn Burns, guilty of first-degree murder in the stabbing death of 18-year-old Michelle Martinko in Cedar Rapids in 1979. Kate Payne, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter, has covered this trial from the very beginning, held at the Scott County Courthouse in Davenport. A judge moved it out of Lynn County due to pretrial publicity. Kate, this trial is over. A verdict has been returned. Very quickly, just shy of 3 hours, it took this jury to return the verdict. What was it like in the courtroom at that moment?
It was somewhat surprising that the jury came back into the courtroom, made their decision so quickly. It was very surprising for those of us in the room because there was so much evidence for them to sift through. What a monumental case, but definitely an emotional moment for the family of Michelle Martinko. Her sister and her sister's husband had been there in the courtroom the entire trial. Other members of their family, students who went to school with Michelle Martinko 40 years ago. So a really emotional moment for them.
And I watched some online video of Jerry Lynn Burns. No visible reaction I could see on the video. What about you?
Yeah, where I was sitting in the courtroom, I didn't have a direct look at his face, but I didn't see much of a reaction either. He was very in control of his emotions the entire trial, but there were a number of people there to support him as well, family members who came to see what his future could hold.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask you to outline the prosecution's key evidence and the defense in this case, remind us, for those of us who might not know, how did this trial come about after 40 years?
Yeah, so at the time, it was hugely shocking for Cedar Rapids. There was no murder weapon, no clear motive in this case. So for decades, it sort of languished. There were always people working it at some level, but it really wasn't until DNA analysis caught up in the past, you know, few years that investigators were able to go back, take another look at this case, and have DNA evidence that came from the crime scene decades ago, have that reanalyzed, and using a family genealogy website that's typically used by hobbyists, they were able to upload the profile that they found at the crime scene of an unknown man, and they got a hit from it, a distant cousin. And based on that information, a private firm was able to build out a family tree, and law enforcement were able to follow those people around, covertly take samples of their DNA from trash that they had left behind, and ultimately narrow their search down to 3 brothers and find Jerry Burns. They followed him to a pizza ranch, picked up a straw that he left behind, tested it, and said it was consistent.
Mm-hmm. 2 weeks of this trial, 2 weeks of testimony. What was the key evidence, looking back, in your estimation, that the prosecution had for this conviction that convinced the jury very quickly, evidently, that he is the murderer?
So it really comes down to that initial genetic profile that was found on the dress that Michelle Martinko was wearing when she was killed, and also more blood that was found in the car where she was stabbed. So investigators were able to point to, in 2 different places at the crime scene, that there was this male genetic profile, that they were consistent to each other. The spot on the dress was found in a blood stain, and jurors found that that was convincing when they were shown evidence that those 2 blood stains, profiles taken from them, were consistent with each other, and that that male profile was consistent with Jerry Burns. that was convincing for them.
Mm-hmm. And how did the defense answer that convincing evidence, it seems?
So they never really contested that the profile was not Burns's. They were really trying to raise other questions about, you know, it's been 40 years. That's a long time. You know, was this evidence ever mishandled? Could there have been a potential for contamination? They also raised the idea that, you know, as we travel around in the world, we're all leaving our DNA all over the place. You know, is it possible that Michelle Martinko encountered his DNA at some other point in time before she was murdered, sort of by accident, picking up his skin cells, say? But that was not convincing for the jury.
And the prosecution answered that with, this is way too far-fetched.
Way too far-fetched. And the idea, again, that the profile consistent with Burns was found in two different places in the crime scene. So it's like the idea of, well, maybe if it wound up on her dress, then how was his DNA then transferred to this blood stain on the gear shifter in the car? You know, how could that have happened?
Jerry Lynn Burns did indeed kill Michelle Martinko in 1979, according to this verdict. Do we know anything more about the motive after all of this testimony?
So before the trial itself, prosecutors had been able to search Burns' computer history during 2018, and they found his taste in porn was very violent, searching things like strangulation, blonde women, those ideas, into stabbing, really, really violent searches. That information was not allowed to be entered as evidence into the trial itself.
The jury did not hear
any. The jury did not hear that. The judge decided, you know, it's been 40 years at that point between the crime took place and he made those searches, and the judge decided that would prejudice the jury and that he should not be put in prison for life based on his taste in pornography. Mm-hmm. So the jury never saw that, but for those who do have that knowledge, it can give a glimpse into some of his thoughts.
Mm-hmm. I know I read that Michelle Martinko's sister, Janelle Stonebreaker, was present during this trial. For the entire family, all the loved ones of Michelle Martinko, what kind of resolution is this?
I think it's incredible for them. And speaking to Janelle and her husband, John, you know, for 4 decades, they had to think about who could possibly have done this to Michelle, to this member of their family. They were second guessing so many relationships, friends of hers. Could it have been them? You know, ex-boyfriends. Could it have been them? Janelle's husband, John, actually had his own DNA taken and tested and compared to this crime scene evidence because there were so many dozens of people who had their DNA collected and compared and were able to be exonerated. So for Janelle, it's not just having the answer of, you know, who killed her sister, but also being able to trust in so many of these relationships
of
people that she knew 40 years before.
Mm-hmm. Judge Faye Hoover set the date for sentencing, which will be in some weeks' time.
We don't have a date yet, but when the verdict came down, she said, yeah, maybe in 6 weeks or so, she'll set a sentencing date.
Okay, Kate Payne, finally, I wonder, are there broader questions that this trial raises that go beyond Iowa's borders, perhaps?
Yeah, so this is one of the first cases of its kind to go to trial, but there are cases across the country where investigators are using a similar kind of method where they're turning to these family genealogy websites. The Golden State Killer in California is another one of these cases, has not gone to trial yet, but very high profile. And so there are real concerns for some about privacy. about, you know, should law enforcement be able to use these websites in this way? Are users who go on, you know, upload their DNA trying to find distant cousins, are they fully aware and consenting to these searches? So some of these companies have had to change their policies to communicate that better. But there are state lawmakers in other states who are trying to regulate law enforcement use of these websites and trying to clamp down on it in some cases.
Okay, Kate Payne, IPR's Eastern Iowa reporter. She covered the trial held at the Scott County Courthouse. Jury of 7 women, 5 men returning a guilty verdict. Jerry Lynn Burns, guilty of first-degree murder in the stabbing death of Michelle Martinko in 1979. Kate Payne, thank you.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week. And as the coronavirus spreads around the globe, let's get an update of what's happening here in Iowa. Also, we'll share some steps you can take to protect yourself and your family. Natalie Krebs is with us, IPR's health reporter. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, Ben.
So, federal officials this week, it seemed to ramp up here in terms of intensity when we're all talking about the coronavirus now. Federal officials say they expect the virus to spread to the U.S. The Center for Disease Control says we need to be a little more aggressive about this in terms of preparation. Let's focus here on Iowa. What is going on, for instance, with the Iowa Department of Health?
Well, yeah. So first of all, there have been about, 60 cases of the COVID-19 in the U.S. None of those are in Iowa so far. And so, in response to what the CDC has done this week, the Iowa Department of Public Health has said that basically they're monitoring the situation in Iowa. They're getting prepared. So that means they said that they are monitoring anyone who's come from, I think, mainland China. They're monitoring them for 2 weeks to look for any symptoms. If there are symptoms, they're testing them. They're also working with the CDC to get, testing kits up here so that they can test people locally. And so far, there have been 2 people in Iowa tested for the coronavirus. Both have come back negative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we can say the risk here in Iowa is at present very low.
It's very low, yes. And public health officials here have been clear about that, too, to say, the risk here is still very low.
I even noticed last week I went in just for an annual physical, and at the desk I was asked if I'd come into contact with coronavirus, and I was kind of shocked by that. But I guess, so things are ramping up. We're prepared for this. What should each of us know to prepare and prevent the spread should it come to Iowa?
I mean, public health officials are just saying basic disease prevention tips, washing your hands, covering your cough if you're coughing, and then most importantly is, staying home from school or work if you have symptoms is kind of the biggest way not to spread anything, flu, coronavirus. So that's what people should be kind of on the lookout for.
Right. And just be aware of what you're touching, because those viruses can stay alive on those surfaces. Elevator buttons, doorknobs, and these things that have become so much a part of our lives, our cell phones, right? We touch those all the time throughout the day, and then maybe you touch your nose, your mouth. You might pick up someone else's cell phone. It's good to be aware of that. Natalie, I heard this tip on NPR today, which I think is a great way to think of it when we think of preparation. To think of it a possible outbreak, and hopefully that won't happen here in Iowa, but the way you would think about preparation for a big snowstorm, and we know that here in Iowa, right? If it never hits, great, but if it does, you're glad to be prepared. And so what do we do during, in the run-up to a big snowstorm? We make sure we have everything we need at home, should we need to stay at home for a while, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, just make sure you have everything, at home, you're stocked up. I mean, it's still respiratory illness season, so I feel like we should all be kind of prepared for cold, flu going around. And you're right, Ben, with all the things we touch, we should probably all be washing our hands a little bit extra, you know, using warm water and soap and singing the happy birthday song twice, I think, to make sure that we're not spreading germs around.
What? I've never heard of this. The happy birthday song. What is that?
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly.
So you wash your hands and you sing the happy birthday song, and that's as long as you should wash your hands to make sure it's really clean.
Yes, I believe that is what, from my days, you know, working with kids, I think that's how long you're supposed to be, you know, washing your hands for with the warmest water possible to make sure you're getting those germs off your hands.
Mm-hmm. And we see on the news, I've seen even around town here in Iowa, people wearing masks. When do we need to think about masks?
I don't think we need to really think about masks. I mean, that is not something that I've ever heard local public health officials bring up as a measure. I mean, I think some people are taking extra precautions. It just goes along with the same thing as, you know, covering your cough and such, just, you know, making sure that you're not spreading germs.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think NPR has done quite a bit of reporting on these masks that it's not conclusive whether wearing a face mask can help prevent people from being infected by the virus. You have to think about how that mask closes around your mouth. And I think in clinical settings, it is definitely something because they're very well trained to use masks. But masks, probably not at this point. Travel, we should think about travel, right? Because it's not been declared a pandemic yet, has it?
It has not. By the World Health Organization, has not reached pandemic level by their standards. But yeah, I mean, travel is one thing. That is probably the biggest thing you can do as an Iowan to prevent, you know, coronavirus right now, is just be careful where you travel. You know, really think about. I know that the U.S. government has, you know, put out a number of places you should really think about, you know, altering your travel plans if you're going to a number of Asian countries. And now there's some outbreaks in Europe as well, too. So that's definitely something to think about, too.
Italy, a hot spot there.
And definitely, yes.
I've seen the CDC has updates. If you would look on the web, travel advisories for any place in the world. And they use a four-level scale, I understand, to rank the risk. One being the lowest risk and four being the highest. So if you do plan to travel, you might check out the CDC travel advisory there. Anything else, Natalie, we should know before we say goodbye?
I think that's about it. Practicing, you know, safe hygienic tips during the season when cold and flu are going around. That's important. And, you know, I think the main thing I want people to know is that, you know, coronavirus risk in Iowa is still very low.
Okay. No panic at all. Low risk. But be prepared. Not a bad thing. And just practice good hygiene as we try to do during flu season anyway, right? Okay.
Right.
Natalie Krebs, IPR's health reporter. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, a few days ago, maybe you caught this in the news, the Iowa Army National Guard announced that hundreds of Northeast Iowa soldiers will be headed to the Middle East later this year. This is the first of several deployments announced by Major General Ben Correll, the Iowa National Guard Adjutant General, during his January Condition of the Guard address to the Iowa Legislature. Let's talk about this first announced deployment with Lieutenant Colonel Garrett Gingrich of the Iowa Army National Guard. He took over command of the Iron Man Battalion in the fall of last year. Lieutenant Colonel Gingrich, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful to have you. And tell us, which National Guard troops will be deployed from Iowa? How many? Where are they from?
Well, there's going to be, I believe, up to about 2,000 soldiers from the Iowa National Guard. I know from the Iron Man Battalion, we've got about 550 soldiers that I'm concerned with deploying just from our unit. And we are going to be the first ones to go out the door. So we're in the midst of our preparations at this point.
Okay. So send-off ceremony, as I understand, for the end of May. What does preparation mean at this time?
Well, there's a lot of medical and other personnel tasks that the Army says that we need to have fulfilled for soldiers to be able to basically go on to Title 10 and federally deploy overseas. So that's what we're focusing on. Additionally, we've got a lot of equipment and things that go along with deploying a battalion that we've got to get prepared for and have make preparations for to have over there or to have at training that we need to use.
Mm-hmm. Where will you be over there?
Well, it's going to be a CENTCOM mission, so it's going to be in the Middle East. At this point, I don't exactly know specifics, but I know CENTCOM is Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, Jordan, mm-hmm. that specific area. Yeah.
So this is a year-long deployment for your battalion.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It'll be approximately a year or so from start to finish. And that includes our pre-deployment training that we'll do at Fort Bliss, Texas.
Okay. Tell us more about your mission. What can you tell us about it?
Well, what we know right now is that it's going to be a force protection security mission. Which really makes sense. We're an infantry battalion. We have infantry tasks that we are generally assigned to do when we are deployed.
What does that mean in everyday terms for
in
people,
everyday terms,
not in the military terms?
Yeah, in everyday day terms, what that means is that we will go over there and we will provide or secure an area or terrain or a base or wherever we're going to be. We're going to basically provide security. So that could be any number of things like patrols. It could be manning towers or control points, which go enter in and out of the bases. Mm-hmm. So that's what we kind of are planning for right now and making preparations for at this point.
How are your men and women feeling about this deployment? When the news came in, is it mixed or what is the feeling as far as you can gauge?
As far as I can gauge, we've got a lot of excited soldiers. They've signed up. They've gotten into the National Guard because they want to make a difference and they want to deploy. And so, you know, you'll have a mixed bag. But the majority of the soldiers are excited to deploy. We've got it's been about 10 years since our last deployment of the Iron Man Battalion. So we've got the majority of our soldiers have not deployed at this point. So they're excited to contribute and to defend freedom and protect our national interests.
Okay, and we thank you very much for your service to our country and the others in the Iowa Army National Guard, Lieutenant Colonel Garrett Gingrich. He is the commander of the Iron Man Battalion. They'll be heading to the Middle East after the end of May. They complete their training. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Colonel Gingrich.
Thanks, Ben.
Interesting, the Iron Man Battalion serving in wars going way back to the Civil War, a long legacy there. Coming up after we take a short break, James Lynch of the Gazette joins me with an update on some things he's been reporting on from the State House. Also, I'll talk with the UNI men's basketball coach. Boy, the Panthers are on fire. We'll ask him about that when we come back. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Welcome back to this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with UNI's the head of the basketball coach there, Ben Jacobson. The Panthers are on fire this year. Maybe you've heard or gone to one of their games. Well, when it comes to politics, James Lynch is always on fire. Let's turn to James to get an update on what happened this week at the Iowa State House. James Lynch, political reporter with the Cedar Rapids Gazette, covering the Iowa State House. James, you've never been told you were on fire before, but there you go.
No. Feel good. Feel
okay. Good. You were at a few things to talk about with you in your coverage. I've been reading your articles from this week, but just a little while ago, you got back from a town hall with Governor Reynolds. What happened there? Where was it?
This was at a coffee shop in Denver. The governor had probably, I'd say, more than 100 people there at 7 o'clock this morning to talk about her Invest in Iowa plan, which is her plan to fund the Natural Resources Trust Fund, to pay for mental health services, to lower taxes, and it all hinges on raising the sales tax by a penny. It's an overall tax decrease, she's quick to point out. Interesting conversation for probably 40 minutes or so, people opinions and asking questions, mostly supportive, although there were a lot of people who wish one part or another of that plan was better. A lot of people want to see more money going into trails. They want to see more money going into water and sort of the outdoor recreation part of the formula, but strong support for the money that will go into mental health funding, you know, the systems that the legislature has passed in the last couple of years haven't fully funded yet. Mm-hmm. And the governor is saying that this would lead to about $120 million in funding for mental health, and that would go up in ensuing years. So it's one of those plans where there's some like, but at the same time, there's something for everybody not to like about it. So she acknowledged it's going to be a heavy lift to get lawmakers to support this because it requires them to vote for a tax increase. And she's telling people, look, legislators, you need to tell them that this is good for Iowa, it's good for the future of Iowa, and convince them to vote for it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's we're only to about the halfway point in the legislative session. And I would say halfway in route to getting the majority of votes she needs to get passage of the Invest in Iowa plan.
Okay. And Governor Reynolds has been holding these town halls across the state, sort of a tour to build the support mm-hmm. for her Invest in Iowa plan. But you say the lawmakers, and I assume you're talking primarily, or is it both Democrats and Republicans that need to be convinced here?
I think it's both. I think maybe right now there's Democratic legislators. Republicans, you know, typically are reluctant to vote for a tax increase, and it's an election year, which makes it even more difficult, I think. But you know, she, like I said, the governor keeps overall tax increase. When you look at the trade-off between the sales tax hike and lowering property taxes by shifting some of the burden for mental health services away from property taxes on the state and lowering income, which she says will benefit most Iowans who pay income taxes. But yeah, it's going to, I would say right now, enthusiasm at the Capitol in the House and Senate, low, not people saying no to this, but mm-hmm. they're definitely not saying yes at this point.
Right. And you wrote this week about a poll released by Iowans for Tax Relief related to you know, funding issues mm-hmm. like this and taxes. What did you pick out of that's relevant here?
Well, they were looking at whether, especially, I mean, given their viewpoint, whether people support a plan to lower taxes, and there was support for that. Again, in there's not overwhelming support. I think it was around 52% support this plan. Which, you know, is a majority, and the governor will take that. But it's not overwhelming support. When you look at some of the various parts of the plan, work your way through the poll, it's interesting that there's, you know, support goes up to 60%, I think it was, in the cities. And there is support pretty much all across the state, but it's higher in the cities than in so. It's going to take, I think, the sort of campaign the governor is waging right now to go out and build grassroots support for this and get people to, you know, talk to their legislators and say, hey, we like this and we want you to support it.
Let's talk about other items at the legislature. Abortion-related bills have been a big theme of this session so far, a variety of legislation there dealing with abortion. Remind us quickly of what's being proposed and what's happened there this week.
Your focus is on what Republicans call the Life Amendment. It would be a constitutional amendment that basically says there is no constitutional right to an abortion in Iowa, and there's no constitutional right to expect the state to pay for it, for tax, pay for an abortion. And this is the result of a Iowa Supreme Court decision that found there was a right to abortion in the state constitution. There was a hearing this week, 2 hours of people talking about mostly and not so much about the constitutional aspects of this amendment. but talking a lot of the same rhetoric we've heard in years past about abortion rights and pro-life and those sorts of things. And, you know, legislative leaders said they didn't expect to hear anything new, but it was an opportunity to give the public a chance to be heard. And, you know, so for 2 hours they were heard. I don't know if it changes anything in terms of amendment. It's been passed by the Senate. The House hasn't voted on it yet. Mm-hmm. But we assume that at some point in this session, you know, in the next 50 days or so, there will be a vote on that amendment.
James, you also wrote this week about how Iowa court cases have been going unresolved longer than national standards. Fill us in on this problem and who's impacted.
Well, this was part of a sort of an annual report the state court administrator gave lawmakers. And they look at national standards. And for example, let's say a felony case should not be pending after, you know, X number of months. Domestic cases, there's a time period that they should be resolved. In every category, Iowa exceeds those national standards, sometimes by quite a bit. I mean, that a high percentage of are still pending after a year or in some cases 2 years. Mm. So there's sort of a backlog building up is what the administrator was telling lawmakers. And it can be costly to the people involved if their cases keep getting delayed, go unresolved, whether it's a felony and somebody is sitting in jail because they can't post bond, or whether it's a domestic case, a dissolution of a marriage that, you know, it drags out, or even in some cases, misdemeanors are pending for a long time. So it can be costly. It also, you know, it takes sort of a personal toll if you're involved in that case, whether you're regardless of which side you're on, I guess you'd say, you know, there's a personal toll of these cases going on. And, you know, I guess there is sort of a concern that if the backlog keeps building up, you know, what's the impact on the court system?
Right.
The administrator goes back to the justice delayed is justice denied. And he an alarm saying people should be concerned about this.
James, we have about a minute before we have to go, but perhaps a quick word on something I know you've been dealing with there, informing yourself about three bills on child care incentive of interest to a lot of people. Tell us about that quickly.
Well, this was a one of Governor Reynolds' priorities. She talked about it in her condition of the state speech. It's a workforce issue. People aren't taking jobs because they can't afford child care or they can't afford it. So these bills that passed through committee this week mostly came at it from the business side, saying if you provide child care, if you pay for child care, you can qualify for some tax incentives. There are some other bills that provide more assistance to low and moderate income families to pay for child care and claim tax credits on their income taxes. So I expect these to keep moving, and I expect more bills addressing child care from both business standpoint, helping families find and afford child care. Like I said, it seems to be a priority across the board with the legislature and the governor.
Okay. James Lynch, political reporter with the Cedar Rapids Gazette, covering the State House with an update on some of the highlights this week at the State House. James Lynch, thanks so much. Always great to talk with you.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week. How about this? This week, the University of Northern Iowa men's basketball team clinched at least a share of the Missouri Valley Conference basketball title, and they came away with the third perfect home record in that program's history. This follows Wednesday night's 84-64 victory over Evansville. Now, the Panthers have secured the Missouri Valley Tournament's number one seed. They will be guaranteed an outright title of that conference if they win at Drake on Saturday in the regular season final. Ben Jacobson joins me now, head coach of the UNI men's basketball team. Coach Jacobson, welcome to the program.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having us on.
Hey, how's morale with the team? I have to believe pretty good.
Yeah, you mentioned the Evansville game, and that was that was a lot of fun for everybody. We had another good crowd in the building, and going into the game, you know, we knew as a program, of course, and our guys knew, and you know, our fans that that have been coming to the games all year long, everybody knew what, you know, what was at stake, you know, with the home game against Evansville, and the guys played great. You know, we had a really aggressive mentality to what we were doing at the offensive end of the floor, and we fought hard defensively, which is something that we talk about a lot, and so that was a really fun night for us to be able to clinch a share of the title, and as you mentioned, you know, we've got an opportunity now on Saturday to get that title outright when we go down to see Drake, which is going to be a tremendous challenge. They've got a terrific team. So it was a great night for us.
Okay, so what have been the keys to your team's success this year?
Oh, I think it always starts with the camaraderie of the group. You know, for us, and having been here for a long time, and you know, building this program a certain way in terms of our recruiting philosophy and what we're looking for, and you know, at the end of the day, it all circles around and wraps around, you know, how much the guys care about each other, how much the guys care about their academic work, how much the guys care about our university and our community, and really at the end of the day, you know, that all adds up to the camaraderie and the chemistry of the group. And then we talk a lot about the leadership that we get from within the team. You know, all of the teams that I've been a part of that have won a championship, the best teams that I've been around as a player or a coach, are really player-led teams. And we've got that this year with our senior group, but we've also got some young guys that have really added to that leadership. But we've got five terrific seniors, and for us, it always starts with our upperclassmen. And those five guys have done a terrific job in terms of the leadership. And so I would tell you those two things are in a really, really good place with this team, and that's what we're, you know, and that's what we're striving for, you know, each and every year is the camaraderie, great leadership from within the team.
When you talk about coach, when you talk about past championship teams, arguably your greatest moment at UNI was that beating in that nail biter, beating number one Kansas in 2010 in the NCAA tournament. How do you capture that kind of momentum, that spark heading into this Missouri Valley Conference tournament?
Yeah, you know, I would, you know, a lot of that relates to what I just mentioned. You know, the older guys doing a great job in terms of leadership, you know, growing in terms of the camaraderie and the relationships throughout the year for our team. So they've got a great trust in each other by the time we get to here. But, you know, now that we're here, and those things are in a great place, we talk with our guys a lot about, you know, about being who we are. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to this point doing these things offensively. We got to this point, you know, doing these things at the defensive end in terms of rebounding the basketball. And, you know, you get all the way here and there's, you know, things will pop up on film. Or maybe some things we did last year or something that I see, you know, watching a college game, you know, last night watching a college game on TV and think, oh, man, this would work pretty good. And what I've learned is, man, you get to this point by really being who you are. So that's something that we stress with our guys at this time of year, you know, and going down to Drake and then we go to St. Louis next week. Like, man, let's keep pounding at the things that we've been really good at and let's, you know, let's be who we are.
Okay, between now and tournament time, you have, of course, the Saturday game at Drake. Between now and tournament time, though, what are the most important things you need to improve? What will you be talking to your team about, drilling them about before that tournament gets underway?
Yeah, you know, the basketball specific stuff. We had a great defensive performance two games ago against Southern Illinois here at home in the second half. We had our best 20 minutes at that end of the floor. We had, you know, it just seemed like you know, defensive stop after defensive stop, and what helped that was our activity level. And that's an area where we, you know, even at this time of year, where we can continue to improve how active we are defensively and how much we communicate at the defensive end of the floor. Those two things could help us a lot as we go to, you know, tomorrow's game and then to St. Louis. And then at the offensive end, you know, and we've talked about it all year, but really talked to the guys a lot here in the last 10 days about the pace in which we play offensively, the cuts that we're making. And then involve and continuing to involve, you know, our guys at the center position. Austin Fife's had a tremendous year. Justin Dahl's been good for us when he's been in. But continuing to make sure we take a look in there and involve our guy at that center position.
Right. At this point, I mean, you've got that big Saturday game and then onto the NCAA tournament. How do you, and you've been around for a while, Ben Jacobson, how do you coach the team to handle this kind of winning streak and the attention that you get?
You know, that goes back to a couple things. One, we, you know, for us, each day is maybe for lack of a better word, Ben, each day is pretty simple. You know, we talk about, getting up, show up on time, whether it's practice or class, you know, a weight room, whatever it might be, you know, that tutor, an individual session with a coach, say, get up, show up on time, and then let's work really hard. You know, so that each day we have an opportunity to get a little bit better, and more people nationally are talking about it. You know, you're in the hunt for a championship, so you've got so many things that are happening around you. And our message to the guys is not different. You know, it's the same thing that we've been telling them every day for 6 months. You know, there's still time to get better, and that I think has been a real key for us. That when we get into mid-February, when you get into late February, when you're playing games in March, there's still opportunities to get better. And So we focus on that part of it. And even though there, you know, what you mentioned, you know, there's so many more things going on around now on the outside, you know, with what people are talking about. Well, if you win this game, well, if you do this, well, if you do, we keep it pretty simple.
All right. Ben Jacobson, head coach of UNI's men's basketball team. If the Panthers win at Drake on Saturday in the regular season final, they will be guaranteed an outright title in the Missouri Valley Conference. Ben Jacobson, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks for having me on.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as we wind up the program, or is that wind down the program, all we need do is to groove into the weekend with IPR Studio One, and we have the Studio One Tracks host Cece Mitchell with us. Hi, Cece.
Hey there, Ben.
This is your debut on River to River. Usually I'm talking with Tony or Mark Simmet, but you know how this works. We've had a hard news week, and we have to transition. We have to groove into the weekend, and that is your role. So please, what are we going to be hearing here?
Sure thing. All right, so this first track comes from Wild Nothing, their latest EP, Laughing Gas, which is actually a collection of five tracks that were recorded during sessions for their 2018 full-length record, Indigo. Wild Nothing actually kind of has made a habit of doing this after releasing their full-length. They'll release a shorter EP after with some tracks that are kind of reminiscent of their last record. Laughing Gas delivers just that, their sleepy, psychedelic dream pop sound that we've come to know and love from the band. This first track, it's called Sleight of Hand, and it definitely delivers that fun sound we know and love from Wild Nothing.
Cece, you've got me bouncing up in my down in my chair. My shoulders are relaxing. Sleight of Hand by Wild Nothing. Unfortunately, we can't hear the rest of that. You can if you tune into Iowa Public Radio Studio One Tracks. One more tune to take us out into the weekend. Cece, what do you have for us?
Yep, sure thing. So Tennis, the indie pop duo of Elena Moore and Patrick Riley, a married couple, they've just released their fifth album, Swimmer, which is super fun. It's got that nice, timeless retro sound and Moore's vocals that we've gone to know and love over the years. But this one kind of has a power pop R&B twist that really, it's super infectious, super catchy. This track that I have for you guys is one of the most innovative tracks on the album, and it will get stuck in your head.
All right.
This is Need Your Love.
Baby, I'm faded, but you will be waiting out.
Ooh, that voice, that melody certainly stuck in my brain already. C.C. Mitchell, thank you very much. IPR Studio One Tracks host, 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock, best in new and old favorites. C.C. Mitchell, thank you so much for grooving us into the weekend.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Let's go out with this bit of Need Your Love by Tennis.